You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to New World Pictures Podcast, where we're going to talk about every movie released by New World Pictures. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
And sometimes the people that made the movies.
And Erica.
What a fun little deed.
That's right. This is an interview. This interview is going to close out Sci-Fi July, an infinity of titles. And we're going to bring back RJ Kaiser. You NWPP VIPs know that we spoke to RJ before about his long career working for New World Pictures as an editor and then as a director. He directed the Raymond Burr scenes of Godzilla 1985, and we talked to him about that as well. There's a whole episode where we talked to him about that. He also co-directed Hell Comes to Frogtown. He edited Up From the Depths and Space Raiders. We talked to him about that, plus Battle Beyond the Stars. Now we're going to talk to him about his work editing Galaxy of Terror. Thank you so much, RJ, for coming back and talking with us. This is actually two interviews. We actually interviewed him twice. We wanted to go back and get more information. So
he's talked to us. He's talked to us like seven or eight times at this point.
Yeah,
right?
He's sick of us.
I don't think he can get enough. I think the opposite. Oh. I think he's addicted.
Yeah, wow. He loves coming on this podcast.
We gave him a taste, and now he's hooked.
I hope you're right, because we'd love to have him back. RJ is terrific. For those of you who have heard our previous interviews, you know this. He's got some incredible stories. He's just an absolute blast to talk to. Yep. Thank you, RJ, for coming back and talking to us about this movie. As we close out Sci-Fi July, an infinity of titles, here's our interview with RJ Kaiser.
As people were wrapping up on Escape from New York, then they were shifting over and doing Galaxy of Terror, which at the time was called Planet of Horrors. It was written and greenlit as Planet of Horrors. Then we couldn't cast anybody. Nobody wanted to work in a movie called Planet of Horrors. And they started casting, and the casting agents came back to New World and said, you know, no one's going to come on board with this title. So let's come up with a classier title, and we might get somewhere. So we came up with the title Quest. So everyone was hired under Quest, and we shot the film
Quest, the name of the ship.
Yes. And then once we got that done, then they did a title test. And they went to...
to a high school?
Because two people, yes.
Which is his usual process to test out titles.
Which is what every studio does. Every studio does this kind of low intelligence approach to these things. You know, Star Wars was rejected by 20th Century Fox. I mean, Star Wars was the lowest rated title. George just said, I'm not changing the title. So, guess we'll keep it. So he sent two people out from his office. Roger sent two people out from the office. One went to Westwood, one went to Venice High School with a list of titles. Westwood crowd, which where UCLA is not that far from. So anyway, that got the Infinity of Terror. That was the high scoring one there. Venice High School, the high scoring was Mind Warp. So Roger said, well, we'll get both audiences if we go Mind Warp and Infinity of Terror. And it's like, okay. All right.
Right.
You can see when the title card comes up how the grain changes on that shot dramatically from everything else, because it went through so many title changes. Change it to this. Oh, no. Well, we should change it to that. Oh, change it to this. And of course, you know, it's a blue-black background, outer space back. No, so of course it shows the grain like anything. You start messing with this, there's no way to match it into what comes before or after. It's just it's a carny business, you know. A trailer is a lie.
Write that down. Everyone write that down.
Yeah. You know? Yeah,
it's just there to get asses into the seat.
That's
and
right.
Get them to park, you know, fork over their $5 or whatever the price is. Get it over. Get them into the seat. You know, I don't care if they stay. They just got to pay the money and get in there.
That's right. Yep. That's right.
That's all. That's all I want.
Now you got you were at the editor on Galaxy of Terror. But
one
you
of
had
the editors.
one of the editors, but you had a very short editing schedule. Was that because of the delays with the shoot or?
No, it was just that's how Roger worked.
Because I know he had more, you had said he had more editors working on it because he wanted to get through it quicker. He
Yeah,
thought
but
that more.
that's just his engineering background. He always loved this notion of how can I save money? Okay, so he was always looking at how do I save money? Because by that point, his company was in trouble. The drive-ins were disappearing. That was his main income. He couldn't figure out, well, what's going to take this place? What's going to take its place? How do we do this? So whenever you're in that kind of a situation, your first recourse is, well, how do I save money? How do I spend as little as I can until I can figure out how do I what the next thing is. So I remember one day he just came to me and he said, how long does it take a film editor to cut a movie? I'm like, well, it depends on the movie, Roger. It's like, what are you getting at? And he says, well, let's say it takes 2 months. And he says, well, I would say 3 months, but okay. And he says, you have one editor. So okay, so if you had two editors, you could do it then. And if it's 2 months, you could have two editors could do it in 1 month. Now, if you had three editors, you could do it in, and if you had four editors, you could do it, and I literally, stopped him and said, well, yeah, Roger, it's the same kind of idea as if it takes a woman 9 months to have a baby, then if you have maybe, two women can do it in 4.5 months, maybe three women can do it in 3 months. And he just said, all right, Bob, you don't have to be so stupid. And then he walked away.
But you edited like the last part of it, which means you are responsible for the most infamous scene of the
Yes,
whole film.
the maggot rape. Yes, 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 yes. And I remember we submitted that film. That film got an X rating twice. Okay, so we got an when we first submitted the film, we got an X rating because of the maggot rape, and I had to go cut it down to get it to an R. And I went through, basically, I called the rating board and I pleaded on their sympathy because the rating board is not supposed to tell you how to recut the movie. They're just there to say, well, no, you get an X. The overall impact of the film, you get an X. You want to recut it and submit it again, that's your prerogative. But we're not going to tell you what to do. So I get this thing and I called them up and I reached somebody on the rating board and I said, look, I'm going to be here all night. Give me an idea. What is it that you found so offensive? And it says, well, the thing with the giant worm and the girl. And I said, okay. Is it too suggestive? And he said, yes. We said, okay, so it's bestiality. Okay, that's your objection. There are too many images there that are bestiality. He said, yes, that's it. Okay, fine. Thank you very much. All right, so I hung up. Okay, I got the idea what to do, and I go through the sequence, and I'm literally taking out 2 frames, 3 frames, a foot here, 8 frames here. I'm going through shot by shot by shot by shot, just saying anything that looks sexual. Anything that looks sexual, overtly sexual, because the original idea of the story of that scene was that at first she's horrified and then she gets into it. So there are two parts. So by the last part, it becomes a sensual experience for her. All right. So I realized, okay, I got to get rid of all the sensual stuff. Get rid of that. Think with the first part, where is she's horrified. Get rid of anything that suggests of suggestive of humping, of any kind of sexual movement of on her part, any shot that could be interpreted that she likes it, get rid of that, get rid of that, get rid of that, get rid of that. It's a lot of little trims. I mean, literally, it's taking 4 frames off of here, 6 frames there, 8 frames off that cut, 2 frames off that cut, 3 frames off that, just literally going on. It looks more horrific there and a little more sensual there. So let's get rid of the sensual part. Let's keep the horrific. You know, it's like it was all that. Because the whole thing was a rapidly cut sequence to start with, because you got to make this stupid looking giant worm look menacing. So, you know, right. You know, it's right. Cutting. It's cutting.
Yeah. That's what yeah. You so you got to, it's rapid. You got to, you can't give the audience,
you can't linger on that thing too long.
Right. So I have a box full of trims. I've saved everything, numbered everything, saved that. We submit it back to the rating board. We get our R. I call Roger and I say, okay, we got the R rating. Really? I'm coming down. Now, Roger was famous for, what did you take out and we'll put it back? Because
as long as it's under 85 minutes, then we're good.
Right. But, and to his point is, well, the people who come to see my movies, you know, they're not the people that are going to complain that it's too hard.
Right.
Sure, it's right. Too rough. Yeah. And it's too overt. So, you know, who's going to complain? I mean, you know, if a mother brings her 6-year-old child in to see this movie, you're going to go, what are you thinking bringing a 6-year-old to see a movie, right. Galaxy of Terror, with that kind of poster artwork? I mean, what kind of mother are you?
Yeah, right, exactly.
So anyway, Roger comes down and he says, you know, Bob, I just can't believe that you got, how did you get that? So you could get an R. I just can't imagine. And I said, well, let's run through. And he says, okay, well, tell me, show me what you took out. And I reached in the box and I pulled out one trim, which happened to be about a foot long. He says, well, we started with this. And he just goes, oh, I can't believe it. You take out 1 foot, we get an R. Well, this is ridiculous. I've never heard of this. Oh, just leave it alone. I mean, it's not even worth putting back. And he walks out. Now, I have a trim box full, and it's like, I'm just starting with part one. That's all I did. And I got 28 trims here.
Uh-huh.
But okay. All right.
Yeah.
Don't look a gift horse in the mouth. All right. That's fine.
Sure. So,
so that's how that happened.
And do you then, it was it after this that you then had to like put in that the investors wanted a love scene, or was that already at this point, was that already just that had already been done by the time you were submitting for the MPAA?
No, that happened. That happened. Boy, I can't remember the order in which that happened. Now, I know we had to show the film to UA.
Right.
And it was the head of UA and the head of foreign sales for UA.
Because they got the foreign rights and Roger had the domestic rights.
Right. And what it just, and I'm going, so this had to happen before we showed it to the MPAA. So I go over to MGM to show it to them and understand that a week or two prior to this, was the whole Heaven's Gate blow up, where the heads of UA were fired or quit or walked off. So the replacement guy, I'm showing this to the replacement guy right after Heaven's Gate, the whole Heaven's Gate controversy.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, because we didn't have a lot of the visual effects done yet. And so how we did things was you just cut in blank leader.
Right.
If you didn't have the shot, you put in white leader. And what I had done was to differentiate. It's like, okay, if we have three visual effects shots that are supposed to go in a row, so you would cut in white leader, red leader, green leader. So you at least you would know, okay, that's shot one, that's shot two, that's shot three. Okay. So I walk into the screening room and the head of the new head of UA looks at me askance and says, what are you doing here? And I said, well, there's a lot of missing material and you won't be able to understand what's going on. So I will tell you what the missing shots are as they fly by. That's the only reason why I'm here. And he kind of grumbles and says, oh, all right. And so they go, we run the movie. And the movie's over and the head of foreign sales turns to me and says, where's the love scene? And I go, what love scene? And he said, we told Roger to have a love. We need to have a love scene between this character and this character somewhere in the story. And he said there would be one. And I'm like, well, I don't know. This is what we got. And I don't know. I don't know anything. I don't know anything about a love scene. He goes, oh, we're going to have to talk to Roger. And he says, oh, okay. You know, so again, I realize, okay, I put my mouth once again and leave. And then Roger comes to my cutting room and he says, you know, the shots of I forget the character's name, but she was the one who gets attacked by the worm. He says, well, we had these scenes.
Taffy,
where,
you mean?
Yes, that's it. And where our lead character is in this chamber, we like a red chamber and then a blue chamber and another chamber, and he's seeing images of his crewmates and in their demise,
mm-hmm.
Haunting him.
Yep.
So we had shots of her topless because she was in her post maggot rape right. appearance.
Right.
And so Roger Roger saying, you know, just put as many shots of her as you can in the sequence. Just keep cutting to her. Find every bit of, find every frame and just put it in. And he then smiled and looked at me and says, in other words, Bob, milk the breasts. And then he left. And again, it's like, it's nothing particularly, it's just shots of her standing there, you know,
right,
topless.
Right.
I mean, but okay, yeah. I'll put.
It's not a love scene. That's right. Just to be clear.
It's, yeah, it's yeah. not a love scene.
Oh, no. So,
but Ryan, I mean, that's in the eyes of the whole.
That's true. Okay? Fair enough. Who am I? Who am I to say?
Yeah. So anyway, so you ultimately UA accepted that, and so that's what we did, and then we got an X rating again because the R rating was conditional, that they had to see the final mix.
Okay.
They had to watch the film again with the final mix, and the first time we sent it to them, they gave us an X again for sound effects. So we had to go back to the mixing stage, and we had to tone down some of our sound effects of flesh tearing and flesh ripping and bone crunching. All of that we had to temper.
I mean, have you ever heard of that happening to anyone else? Just for sound effects to get an X rating?
Right. That's it's probably one of the only times it's ever happened.
It's crazy. Wow. That's crazy.
I've now, never partly, heard of that.
Partly it's also they are the rating board is stricter on independent films than they are on the majors.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, I think they did not like the movie, and they were just taking every opportunity to harass us.
Yeah, sure. They were thinking that this thing is gross.
Yes. And I think they were angry that they had to keep watching this thing over and over again because we were always having to resubmit this film to them.
Yeah. And they're like, oh boy, here we go again.
Yes.
I know. I'd heard Rogers talk about editing. He said that he usually leaves the director and editor alone for the first cut. And then he says once they're going to show him the first cut, he says he's too busy. I can't see the first cut. Just go ahead and make your cuts for the second cut. So that way he could come in really for the second cut. And that's the first one that he would actually watch. Is that true?
Pretty much. It depends on the project. If he felt good about the director, that's what he would do. If he wasn't sure about the director, then he would look at the first cut.
How did he feel about Bruce Clark? Well, on this particular project. I know he'd worked with him before.
He had worked with him before, but it was a while ago.
It was in the late 60s on a biker movie.
There's a big gap. So he wanted to see the cut. I think basically he was just like, you know, is it going to hold up? Is this going to be a good project for me to push with the various distributors I got to deal with, you know, around the country? It was more just to answer that question in his own mind. It was not about, I don't feel, you know, good about the director or anything like that. It was just to satisfy his curiosity as to what does he have to market?
Right. And it was towards the end of his time with New World. He sells the company shortly, too long after Galaxy of Terror.
Yes, I thought he sold it when we were on Space Raiders.
It was in the top of 83, he sells the company.
Okay.
So Space Raiders is for Millennium, for the company he does.
Okay, right.
Where he's making movies for New World, but now in the capacity of...
I think we started Space Raiders as a New World picture and ended it, as a Millennium.
It gets released by New World, but his little company at that time is called Millennium. It's only for like four movies, and then he sets up Concord. But he was making movies for New World to put out.
Right. Oh, which they did for like a distribution deal, yes.
Yeah, but they distributed for like a year, and then they stopped distributing his movies, and then he sued them, and then they sued, and they had that whole thing.
Always turns into a lawsuit.
Yeah.
Everything turns into a lawsuit.
And so when you edited this, was this still, like, did you do this in the shack up on in the lumberyard?
Yes, in the shack.
Is that where you...
We were on the second floor. Second floor of the shack. I think on the first floor was Saturday the 14th. I think that was that's where that was being cut, and we were up on the second floor.
Wow.
Yeah, that was awful. What an awful building. God, what an awful building.
By just it being called the shack, I'm imagining it didn't probably have the best air conditioning.
What's air conditioning? What is this thing you call air conditioning?
Also
remember now we're not that far from the beach.
Right.
You can walk to the beach.
Yeah. From the lumberyard in Venice.
Where we are. And
it sounds like you have to if you want to actually try to cool down.
Well, yes. It was never that hot.
Okay.
At the shack. What we discovered was corrosion. Okay, salt in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Everything metal just started to get very rusty. You have your reels that you have sliding onto the spindle of your rewinds. Well, very quickly your reels would not slide very smoothly on the spindles, and you're pulling them to get out again, and then you're pushing them to get them off, and the splicing block is like not cutting the way it used to. And
wow.
There was this constant sitting there with, having to get sandpaper, and constantly going and sanding it down a little bit to get the rust off of these things.
Oh my goodness.
Yes, it was a royal pain.
Now, weren't you in that setup too? Wasn't it like there was like three sections for editors basically?
At least on the second floor, it was, imagine one floor with a wall that runs longitudinally down the middle of that floor, except for maybe 10 feet at one end and 10 feet at the back end. So which is opened all the way from side to side. And then you got this one wall that runs partway down the middle. So you would have one editor on one side, one editor on the other side, another editor on the other side, and a couple of assistants scattered around.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had a loft that was partly above the middle where you could store stuff.
Okay.
But there was no fence or net.
So you could just walk right off it if you...
You could walk right off it. And what frequently happened is someone would go up to fetch something and you're trying to get it and you shove a box to get at the item. That box shoves another box, which shoves another box, which shoves another box, which knocks another box off the ledge and down onto whoever is the poor soul working down below. Suddenly, out of nowhere, box of empty gold bill reels come crashing down all around you. No one got seriously hurt, but I was hit twice by Goldberg reels falling off the
wall. Do you have, and how was it working with other editors right there? Did that cause, I know there was power issues a lot, especially when they were doing Battle Beyond the Stars. Did you have encounter those same issues? You had editing downstairs,
every now and then the circuit breakers would trip and you'd have to you know, run around and figure out which circuit did it and where's the fuse, or is it a circuit breaker, where is it, and you know, figure out, we have to re-plug, okay, get another bunch of extension cords and don't plug that moviola there, plug it down over here, and you know.
And meanwhile, they're shooting the movie in the actual studio, right?
Well, that was in the other building across the way.
Oh, okay.
So there was no shooting in the shack.
Right. No. Yeah. I was thinking the shack was above the studio, but this is the building that was just in the lumberyard, but away from the actual studio building.
Yes. There was the big building, which was the main stage. And then they built a smaller building out of, you know, one of these kind of like do-it-yourself storage sheds that you can go to Home Depot or equivalent and buy. So they built this additional shed that was our extra stage. So we are right under the takeoff flight path of Santa Monica Airport. So every 3 minutes there is a plane flying over us, and everyone just learned, it's like, you know, time the plane, okay, we got 2.5 minutes to get this shot, okay, and all right, before a plane would come by.
Wow. Even in the studio,
there, nothing was soundproof. Was soundproof. You know, you had some ferny blankets that were tacked up on the wall, tacked up on the ceiling, but you know, that's a ferny blanket is not sound insulation.
right. That's amazing. That had to be so frustrating. But yeah, it is what it is.
It is what it is, you know. And if you listen carefully, you can hear, you know, the tail end of an airplane by, you know, in some of the dialogue tracks.
Really? Wow. Yes. Okay. Did you have any interaction with Bruce Clark when you were editing the movie?
Oh, yeah, you know, he came in and he did a director's cut, you know. So yes, he sat with us. He was very miffed when he found out that we were cutting while he was still shooting. He expected us to wait for him to shoot the film, and then he would come in and he would then review material, and we would, you know, he would proceed to build a cut. I remember him telling us that. We just looked at him and it's like, what planet are you on? I mean, this is Roger Corman.
Right. It has been a while since you worked for Roger. Yeah, you know,
in 5 days, when you finish shooting, we are expected to show a fully executed cut.
Wow. Five days.
And he thought he was being generous. He expected it in three.
And is that with sound and music and everything, or just
No, just a cut. Just a cut.
Otherwise, I was thinking that was 5 days of a lot of no-dos, because there's no way you can sleep.
That's why, again, he thought it was very doable, because, well, there are three editors, you know.
Right.
What are you, you know, it's not like I'm asking you to do the whole film and that. No, you each have, I mean, I had four reels, Larry Bach had four reels, and Barry Zetlin had 2.5.
Got it.
So what, in your interactions with him, what did he like or what did he not like? Or was there anything that he...
You know, I really don't remember. You just kind of run the reel for him, and he would say, you know, is there a blah, blah, blah? And I would go, no. And, well, is there something there? And I go, no. And says, is there this and that and the other? And I go, no. And that, no. Oh, okay. Well, then let's take another look at it. Well, I guess it's fine then. He would go off to the other editor. So
he would just come in and look at your section and then go over to Larry and watch his section.
And then go over to Barry, look at his section. You know,
interesting.
Around, you know.
What's amazing?
He saw the whole film, you know, at a screening. You know, we do a screening of the whole film, and then he would come in to work with us.
Oh, okay. All right. That makes sense.
Yeah, because I was about to say, it would be amazing for him to have such great awareness of what the whole picture is, if he's only seeing it, like coming in and seeing it in these little parts, right, to be able to provide direction and be like, but you know, I understand where the movie's going, but I guess if he saw a full cut of it and then he was like, now we'll start to break it down, then that makes more sense.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, you have to do that because you're on reels. I mean, we're on film, we're on reels, you know, 10 minute reels. That's what we're working with. So even if you saw it, you saw the full run in the screening room and you come back to the cutting room. Well, you know, everything's in a 10 minute section. So,
right.
What was curious, I remember when we did the very first cut, and getting it ready to take to show Roger and Bruce for the first time, as we would finish a reel, we would run the reel for ourselves in the cutting room. We would all gather. We had a moviola with arms, and we'd thread up. You know, let's watch the whole film, but we couldn't do changeovers. So you know, okay, we went one reel at a time. Blah, blah, blah. And with each reel, we go, wow, that's pretty good. Wow, that reel's pretty good. Oh wow, that reel's pretty good. That reel's pretty good. So we watch the thing. We're thinking, you know, hey, you know, this maybe we got a halfway decent film here. And then we get to the screening room and we watch the film as a full entity film. And we're all like this, you know, halfway through the film, we're like, you know, oh my God, this isn't working. This isn't working at all. And it just, you know, it was like one of my first early lessons of you can't judge it 10 minutes at a time. You got to see it in a run, because what starts to happen is there's a sameness in the cutting pattern. Mm. And if you're watching it 10 minutes at a time, you don't see that sameness.
Right, right.
When you watch it as a full film, you suddenly realize that it's, okay, we go bup, 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 bup. You know, you realize, oh, this is just dragging.
Right, because, yeah, you're talking about pacing and you're talking about how the film is moving, which is another element I would think is also the difficulty when you have three different editors that everybody has their own rhythm. So how do you work that out?
That's not really as much of a problem.
Okay.
As we thought at the time, it really isn't that much of a problem because the material tells you what to do. I mean, the material, you got the script, you got how it was shot, and yeah, your individual cut points, you know, no two editors cut it exactly the same way, but essentially you got what you got and you're going to convey the same information. The saddest thing was that anything that was intentionally shot to be a humorous note was ruthlessly eliminated by Roger when he came on board. He didn't want to give an audience any excuse to laugh. So if you had a deliberate scene that was there to make an ironic comment or a humorous comment, boom, that was gone. That was gone. I remember sitting, he was next to me when we were doing a cut. We were screening a cut for him. And he had a notepad and he had a pen that had a light so he could see what he was writing. And I'm sitting there and I had my pad and I just started noting that every time I saw, I could see out of the periphery of my eye whenever his pen light would come on. And I would note what was going on in the film at that moment. I would, you know, it's like, oh, we're on reel five. It's the scene in the galley. I just quickly make a note. And sure enough, when I got back and I compared my note and ran through the film, it's like, oh, yeah, that's a funny. Yeah, that's a humorous thing. That's supposed to be ironic. That's supposed to be humorous. That's supposed to be. And it's like, yeah, he's taking everything that kind of leavened the mood. He was just taking out. And sure enough, you come in and say, that's out, that's out, that's out, that's out, that's out, that's out.
So if he listened to our podcast, he would probably
cut it to nothing.
But 2 or 3 minutes. He'd probably need Ryan's research and then that's it.
Gotta go. Exactly. That's it.
He'd be like, just take Erica out completely.
I mean, that's what was so weird with Up From the Depths was because, you know, it was like he just gutted that film. Just gutted it.
Yeah.
It was the strangest thing to watch. Not that it was particularly rip-roaring funny, but at least it was mildly humorous. He just gutted that thing.
It's so weird. I know it's been a long time, so I understand you may not remember, but do you remember any humorous moments that he took out of Galaxy of Terror that
Well, the one I remember, the scene which we all liked, there's a scene in where Ray Walston is reading a book. And the actor he wound up playing Freddy Krueger.
Yeah, Robert Englund.
Yeah, Robert comes by and looks in and goes, "What's that?" And Ray Walston goes, "Why, it's a book." It's like, "A book? What is that?" You know, he says, "Well, it's, you know, writing, and it's a story, and it's this and that, you know." And Robert Englund looks like, "Oh my God, this is the most evil thing I have ever heard about." And it's like, "Why are you doing that?" And he says, "It's entertaining." And it's like, "Oh," and he walks away. All right, not a big deal, but you know, it's sure. A science fiction movie. Okay, yeah. You know, different culture, whatever.
Sure. All right.
We like the scene. It was well played. It was well done. It didn't take very long. You know, it's not like it's holding up the show.
Right.
And sure enough, bang. You know,
he cut the whole thing.
It only lived in the first cut, and then it was gone.
Wow.
Wow. Now, did you screen the cuts with Roger? Like, just you're saying you're screening it with him right there. Did you screen it for both him and Bruce at the same time? Or
yes.
But there were also times you would screen it just for Roger.
And sometimes they're just for Roger. Yes. So,
and so how
the very first screening was for both Bruce and Roger. You know, we were all in the screening room there at his office in Brentwood, which was a really tiny screening room. Really tiny screening room. Three rows of seats. The seats were all director's chairs. Mm. So the back row were the really tall director's chairs. The middle row were the medium-sized director chairs. The front row were the sort of regular director's chairs. So, it was really tiny. And the screen had a wrinkle in it that ran at a diagonal from the lower left-hand corner to the upper right-hand corner. So you had this wrinkle that was there in the image. There was no official projectionist. Had a secretary taught how to run the projector. So she would run the show. On Battle Beyond the Stars, I taught her how to do changeovers. She didn't know how to do changeovers. So for one screening, I stayed in the projection booth and walked her through, here's how you do a changeover.
Wow.
Got to save that money somewhere, right?
Yeah. Right. That's right.
That
same screening room was my cutting room for Up From the Depths, I'll have you know. That's where they set up my cutting room when it was under construction. So my editing bench and my moviola were all in there with sawdust all over the place.
Oh, wow.
I was constantly having to wipe the sawdust off the print.
Oh, my God.
Goodness.
Yes. Yes.
So though, there were times that you screened for Roger and he would suggest cuts. Now, would you then have to hear from Bruce, like, you know, when?
No, because what happened is after a certain, we had a, Roger watched it all with Bruce, and then he turned to Bruce and said, "You go ahead and do your cut. And then let me know when you're ready to show it again." So Bruce, rather than doing his cut, he turned to his partner, who was the producer, and told the producer, "You do a cut. You sit down with the boys and you do a cut." So we were working for him. And then we showed that to everyone, Bruce and Roger and everyone. We had another screening. And then Bruce came down one more time, worked with us, and then he was gone. He was gone. And I remember turning to the producer and saying, "What happened to Bruce?" And he said, "We went back north." And it's like, he's not, so he, it's, and it was like, he didn't want to talk about it. So I don't know what happened. All I know is that Bruce was back north and I never saw him again.
Wow. And he didn't really direct much after that.
Right. Right.
So he had the time of his life, I guess.
He was like, "I did it. Check the box. Going home
check
now.
Check the box. Going home.
I've said all I need to say."
Yes. I think he probably realized that was that Roger is going to get what Roger wants.
Mm-hmm.
The film is not going to be a Bruce Clark movie. It's going to be a Roger Corman movie, no matter what. And I think he figured, well, you know, life's too short. I'm just going to get out of here, rather than rather than suffer heartbreak, I'm going to leave.
I mean, and he would not be the first or last director to, you know, get to learn that lesson. I would say.
Yes.
Yeah.
I always felt bad for Jimmy Murakami about all that. Felt bad about it. We treated him abominably. It's a shame what we did to him.
But he stuck around for the entire editing process, did he not? He didn't leave at any point, right?
Oh, he left. He was gone.
He wasn't there for any of the editing?
He was only there for about 3 weeks of it, and then he was gone.
Wow.
Wow.
He was gone.
Now, when you say we, like, do you mean just sort of New World in general, or how they treat him, or was it like everybody just sort
everybody,
of treated?
Everybody. Visual effects, editorial. It was just everybody. Production crew. I mean, he had a, you know, I mean, this is not a, you know, the whole, this particular recording is not supposed to be about Beyond the Stars, but just very quickly, that was like a movie by committee, you know, and everybody had an opinion on what it should be, and everyone had an opinion on how they should do it, and no two opinion was the same. Nothing meshed. So visual effects was making their movie, and within visual effects, there were three or four power groups with there. They were making their movie. Editorial was making its movie. Production, you know, Daniel Lacombe with the DP was making his movie. The actors were making their movie. You know, it just, and it's just watching all that going on. It was like this is surreal.
Yeah. Well, he definitely, you know, it was a huge production, one of his most expensive productions, even though Orion was really supplying the money to make it. He had bought that facility, and Jimmy Murakami had never done really a live action, right? He was an animator.
Right.
So he really kind of threw him into the deep end and just said,
best
luck.
And then literally walked away, you know, didn't offer him much help at all. Just sort of, well, here you go and good luck.
I know he came into that one scene on Akir where it had all the players pretty much in it, that Roger was there for that, but that he wasn't around much more than that. And like a Galaxy of Terror, he came in and Bruce was like, go for it, in terms of directing the day with the worm and, you know, Taffy.
Oh, no, that was Jim Cameron directed that.
He did that?
Yes. Jim Cameron directed the worm scene. With Taffy O'Connell,
the giant worm,
Jim Cameron directed that. That was all a second unit shoot.
Wow. Okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that, because I knew that Jim had made the like little worms that like the maggots or whatever, like those weren't moving or anything, and he put a little electricity through it. I know that to try to get them to move. I know he had done that, but I didn't realize he had actually directed that scene.
Yes, he directed that scene.
Interesting. For me, one last question. Roger also had said that if the director or editor disagreed with a note that he had, he would let it go. How true was that statement?
Not mine.
it did sound a little like it's not, nothing I've heard backs that up from anyone.
Yes. We had the absurdity of I think I might have told you on Space Raiders where we had to do an insert shot. We're going to have to do a pickup shot of the kid opening the drawer to pick up something out of the drawer. And we hadn't shot it yet. And so, you know, I sat down and I went to a drawer in the cutting room and had my assistant with a stopwatch. And I like tried it and said, I did like three, four different ways and said, how much time was that? And it says, okay, what's the average of the four? All right, it's that. Okay, so I took a piece of white leader, measured it off. That's equivalent. Cut that in. Roger comes in. We're going through the cut. The white leader comes up and he goes, what's that? And they go, that's the insert shot of the drawer that we're going to do next week. He goes, oh, what happens in that shot? He says, well, he opens the drawer, gets the thing out, and closes the drawer. He says, huh, run it for me again. Back up, I run it for him again. He goes, take a foot off of that.
But you had, even though you hadn't shot anything.
Right. It's wow. just white leader.
Wow.
Take a foot off of that. Okay.
Wow.
So he was.
He knows what he wants.
Yes, he knows what he wants. Right. And we had learned, you know, that after I worked for him a while, I realized that if I have no sound playing under a shot, he will cut that shot in half, at least. Mm-hmm. So I would cut. Room tone, sound effects. I would find stuff just so the track would not go dead. If I had a shot, you know, an MOS mm-hmm. shot, mm-hmm. I would just put something there. I'd find piece of music, whatever. I would just put something there because I just knew that if it was absolutely dead silent with nothing going on, he would cut it in half.
All those sounds of boxes falling off the loft.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you're being attacked by him.
But you have to, you learn what Roger's routines are. You learn what his thinking was. And you would, he was the auteur at that company. You know, there's no director. The director is simply there, is the traffic cop to kind of get it from nothing into some celluloid that he can then come in mm-hmm. and shape.
Hmm.
Yeah,
the producer as a tour.
And Roger didn't want to do the initial shaping. You know, he would let the director do the initial shape, but he would come in and do the final shape.
Hmm.
Right.
And that was that. And that, you know, and you just had to learn to make your peace with that approach. You would have some surreal conversations. I remember on Space Raiders with Howard Cohen. And Howard Cohen, we were running the cut, and Howard was in the room. And I'm at the moviola, Roger's at the chair next to me, Howard's standing, looking over Roger's shoulder, and we're running something, and he has me stop, and he goes, we ought to trim the tail of that shot. You should take a second off that. No, wait, how many frames? No, take a foot. How many frames are there in a foot? And before I could answer, Howard goes, there's 40. Now, of course, in 35 millimeter, there are 16 there are 16 frames. And in 16 millimeter, there are 40 frames to the foot.
Hmm.
Okay, so Howard's thinking 16 millimeter, and he goes 40 frames. And Roger sits there, oh, no, Howard, don't be ridiculous. There's 24. Take 24 frames off that cut. And it's like, okay, right, whatever.
From wherever?
From the tail of the cut.
Okay.
From the tail of the cut. So what I was doing after my second film with Roger is I would make Roger's notes and then I would do what I would do.
Got it.
I wouldn't just slavishly go through and do his notes. He would say, take two frames off of that. I'd run the thing and say, that's the cut. And I would leave it alone and, wait for him to say,
Say it again.
And usually it was always, how many frames did I say to take off the end of that cut? And I would go through my page. Oh, you said to take two frames off. Take another two. Mm. And write down, okay, take another two frames off that cut. Okay. On Galaxy of Terror, there's one cut where we spent, first he said, take two frames off. Then next time he looked at it, he said, what did I say for you to take off? I said, well, you said to take two frames off. Put the two frames back. Okay, put the two frames back. Then the next time you look at it, he says, that's still not right. What did I tell you to take off? Well, you originally told me to take off two. And the next time you looked at it, you told me to put the two back. He says, okay, take off one. And I would take off one. And the next time you come and look at it, it says, that's still not right. What did I tell you to take off? What did I tell you to do? And I said, well, I wound up taking off one frame. Put the frame back. All right, put the frame back. Okay, take a look again. It says, still not right. Take two frames off. All right, take the two frames off. All right. And we went like this, this thing, I just had this one pin on my one bin that I just had the material. It goes out, it goes in, it goes out, it goes in, it goes out.
And you just got used to it because that's just working for Roger, right?
Yeah, that's what you do.
And that's it. That's our interview with RJ Kaiser. Also, you know, you didn't even see the little extra bit about Battle Beyond the Stars or even some of those little tiny nuggets there about Space Raiders. Yeah, so I didn't even tell you about it. So it was all nuggets. Surprise.
Mm-hmm. It's like those when you go to Long John Silver's and they give you those old nuggets in the basket. Like that, it was full of those little nuggets.
Boy, so many people are like, I know exactly what you're talking about.
I miss Long John Silver's. Does it still exist?
Don't we all miss it?
We all miss it. And you know what?
I'm saying,
you know what the only cure for it is? RJ Kaiser comes back again.
Yes.
On the New World Pictures podcast.
And we
also, Captain Silver, if you are looking for a cheap sponsorship deal, we're here for you. We can be your spokespeople.
Thank you for calling
him
by
cheap, but I think he meant to say dedicated sponsorship.
You're right. Dedicated and inexpensive.
And thank you for using his proper title and not his nickname of Long John, which I think was derivative. I think we can all agree.
Yeah.
When really he is a captain. Let's have some respect.
Long John was his porn name, and it just got turned into a whole franchise. But Captain is what he prefers to go by.
People don't even acknowledge his medical degree. He was actually Captain Dr. Long John Silver. And that's how I know him.
Thank you so much, RJ, for coming back to the show. We hope you enjoyed this episode.
You.
If you want to catch up with all of our other interviews with RJ Kaiser and all of our interviews in general, you should go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. You can catch up on more interviews about some of the sci-fi movies that have been released by New World Pictures. In fact, we have an interview from just this month with Ernest Farino, who worked on several of those movies, including Galaxy of Terror. So check all those interviews out at our website. Buy a t-shirt. It helps support the show. We'll see you next time at the New World Pictures Podcast, part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network, please select the link in the description.
Maggie is a troubled young woman who just wants to watch an old horror movie on streaming. Her aging Gen X uncle gets word of this and says, "No, no, no, you gotta watch it the best way, on old school DVD." But the disc ain't right, and horror ensues. That is the story of Dead Media, the world's first haunted DVD movie, and it is coming to cities across the U.S. this summer and fall. For tickets and full details, check out antennareleasing.com/films/deadmedia, because some folks may be done with the DVD, but it's not done with you.